You're listening to The
Bike Show on Resonance
104.4 FM.
Welcome to The Bike Show here on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Jack Thurston. This is our second look at the Paris-Brest-Paris bicycle ride, or Randonnée, which is one of the world's longest bicycle races. And I think the race has been going for the longest time, all the way back to 1891. At 1,200 kilometres, it's a very, very long ride, and that for many people takes several days to complete. Well, with me in the studio are three people who finished this year's Paris-Brest-Paris: Judith Swallow, Dave Minter and Pete Kelsey. And we also have on the line Chris Ragsdale, all the way from Seattle. I'm going to start with our guests in the studio and ask you, what could possibly possess you to want to ride for such a long time and to subject yourself to such extreme physical discomfort of staying on your bike for 3 days and three nights? Judith?
Because friends had already done it and it sounded really an exciting thing to do. And that's how I got into it, for friends that were already riding.
So was it a kind of, sort of like the public health people talk about, getting into hard drugs, that, you know, it's the occasional, puff on a joint, you know, the occasional 100-kilometre, 200-kilometre CTC ride, and then, you know, before you know it, you're conked out on a concrete floor in a village hall, and the Audax equivalent of shooting up heroin in a bus shelter. Slippery slope, in other words.
No, because my first PBP in 1999, I did it on a tandem, and we got round in 69 hours with loads of sleep, broke the tandem, mended it three times. So, no, we had just a ball going round and a very easy ride. So, no, none of that, unfortunately.
Dave?
Well, it was a bit different. I read an article in a cycling magazine years and years and years ago, and I just thought that sounded really, really cool. So,
what sounded cool about it?
The idea of riding. I was living in Australia. I was, only a little bit out of school, and the concept of riding through these French villages and towns with people out clapping and cheering in the middle of the night and parties going on just to cheer you on, just to help you get through and be part of the history of this event, you know.
And Pete, what was your entree?
Well, I'm a relative novice to the world of Audaxing. So my first ever long-distance ride was in 2009, the London-Edinburgh-London, which is the UK equivalent. And I got round, but I had a pretty terrible experience. I wasn't really prepared for it. And then I thought, well, maybe long distance cycling is for me. It's just too hard and too demanding. And but then I heard about PBP and people were talking about it in sort of cycling magazines. And I thought, well, maybe I'll give that a go. And it's a different experience. And it was. It was a completely different experience for me.
And you've all probably come to it as, you know, experienced cyclists, I imagine. What are the differences in riding that distance?
Well, you have to obviously be the element of self-sufficiency. That's one of the kind of part of the ethos of Audax riding, and so riding within yourself as well. It's not a race. People talk about PBP as a race, and it is for the elite riders, but generally it's sort of managing your resources, and you don't have to be an athlete to finish long distance riding, but you do have to, you know, be relatively self-reliant and know your limitations.
Well, let's turn to one of those elite athletes, Chris Ragsdale, all the way across the shining sea in Seattle. Chris, welcome to the bike show.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for having me.
So, like Pete, this year was your first PBP, but you came to the ride as one of the stars, or the vedettes, as they say in French. You wanted to be the first back to Paris, right?
Well, that was the goal going into it. Like you said, this was my first PBP, but I had actually done 3 1200s before this, and you know, my intent when going into it was really just to see if I could hang with them and to see how quickly I could get it done.
And how is the PBP different for the elite riders like you as compared to the main crowd?
I was actually shocked at how different it was. I had heard so many stories about PBP from local members of my club here, and you know, talked about, you know, the amazing spectators and the controls and what it was like to have this amazing, you know, event put on. It was incredible. What I found from the lead pack was just going into these controls was very chaotic and, you know, a little bit dangerous.
In what way dangerous?
Just the amount of crashes and logistics coming into it, you know. The lead pack was still probably, I don't know, 100 guys, you know, 300-400 kilometers into it, and you know, the last 5-10k before every control basically turned out to be very similar to a criterium race. You know, everybody wants to be near the front, and you know, we were being led through the towns by the motorcycles, and things can get hairy.
So did you know who you were up against? I mean, they say it's not a race, but I guess for you guys it is a race.
You know, it's interesting. I've been told it's not a race as well, but I don't know, my theory on it is anybody who's capable of riding, you know, 50 hours or less nonstop is probably competitive by nature and wanting to see how they fare against the others. So, you know, it's an interesting combination where we all need to work together to see how quickly we can get there, but also trying to, get there as quickly as we can for ourselves. And, it's certainly not a race, but it's not far from it.
Tell us a little bit about the kind of mind games that are going on there. I mean, are you psyching each other out?
I mean, absolutely, yeah. There was a time on the way back between, I think it was Carhe and Ludiak. We were in the hills, and we were still a much larger group than we needed to be. We were probably 50 people still, and one of the Frenchmen attacked really hard, like it was a road race, and, you know, trying to thin that pack out. And, you know, I was playing some mind games as well, you know, going to the tack and going to the front and attacking really hard to try and, you know, let everybody know that I still was capable. And I think that there's quite a bit of that stuff going on. I know that some of the previous first finishers were in the group and, you know, playing games with controlling the speed and the tempo going into controls and things. So, yeah, there's definitely that element to that lead pack.
And you've all got your support crews who are helping you out. One of them, of your support crew, is a friend of the bike show, Damien Breen. How does that work? How does that relationship work between you and your guys who are at the controls, making sure you're fed and watered and all the rest of it?
You know, I was really fortunate to have some experienced guys sort of tell me what it was like up there. It was pretty chaotic. It was probably 200-300 people at the controls when we were going into them, spectators, every rider there had multiple crew people there. So I had set my crew up with a green handheld strobe light so that they could hold it above their head and I would be able to easily identify where they were at. You know, beyond that, it was really just trying to force my way through a sea of people to try to get to them to hand off my bike so I could run in and get my card signed and try to get back out to them. we had done numerous things, like put a front bag on my bike in order to make it so that they could see what I had eaten and what I hadn't eaten, so that they could replenish that food while I was gone, rather than just working from the, you know, back pockets. And that strategy helped a lot.
And so what kind of training does it take to get into the kind of shape to ride a sub 50-hour Paris-Brest Paris?
You know, I mainly consider my large events. I do usually 5, 6, 7 major ultra-distance races a year, and my races tend to be my training. So I feel like I'm maintaining a large load just from event to event. So.
But how did you get into it? I mean, how did you get to do your first one? How did you get to that level? Where did you realize that you were really good at this?
it was a relatively slow evolution, I think. I got into it by doing a double century, a 200-mile ride, and then it evolved from there. I started riding with the Seattle Randonneurs, and that became my training, you know, simply covering the 100, 200, 400-kilometer events was enough for me to take it to the point where I was doing 24-hour races. And, you know, now I do less and less sort of big double centuries and training rides like that, and mainly just maintain a large mileage base through doing my events, and then some intensity work in between those. So,
and a lot of the talk about Paris-Brest Paris, and I'm sure we'll talk about it with the guests in the studio, is about sleeping and how to sleep, when to sleep, for how long to sleep. But for you, there was no sleeping in the plan, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I never got to sleep, and that was really my big concern going into this event. I've struggled with sleep in the past and been forced to sleep during the rides when I didn't want to. And one of my big strategies going into Paris-Brest Paris was to get to the event 4 days early and basically just be by myself and relax. And I was trying to get 10 hours sleep a day for 4 days prior. So I wanted to get 40 hours rest in 4 days prior to the event.
With jet lag.
Yeah, I wanted to get over the jet lag and just feel well-rested and have all my things together and set to go without the stress of having to prepare in the couple of days prior. So I think that was a big deal for me, being able to push through those, you know, 44 hours without sleep.
And so you were in great shape, you were doing really well, but it all went slightly wrong with a navigational error. Talk us through what happened there, and how did that happen, and what were the consequences?
It was a bit of a bummer. We were on the way back. I had mentioned just a moment ago that the Frenchman had attacked and thinned out the pack quite a bit, and we had pushed through into the thunderstorm in between, like, I think it was just before Tintiniac, where it was a massive thunderstorm, and we were trying to maintain the gap we had opened up on the rest of the group there. And it was between Tintiniac and Fougères that I had been spending a lot of time on the front, and there were two motorcycles basically rotating along, sort of guiding our way. And I don't recall exactly when we got off course, but I do know we came up onto a major intersection which should have had a sign, and, you know, we all stop and we're looking for the sign, and there's no sign, and one of the Frenchmen communicates with the motorcycle drivers that, you know, where are we at? Are we on course? And sure enough, we were off course. Everybody turned around, and turns out we were about 20 kilometers off course, and so by the time we got back onto course, we had done 40 kilometers extra and got into the Fougères control about 25, 30 minutes behind a lead group of six at the time. So.
And you weren't able to close that gap, but you did come in the second group, and that was a terrific ride. Are you going to come back for another one in 4 years' time?
I think so. Yeah, it was just such a great event to be a part of. I'd like to go back for sure.
Okay, well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for joining us. Judith, Dave, Pete.
Thank you.
Is that familiar, or is that all part of a weird other world?
Well, that's a little beyond what we do. We're out there basically having fun and enjoying the ride. He sounds like he enjoyed parts of it, but it sounds like bloody hard work.
It strikes me that long-distance riding is different from normal bike racing in the following way, that most bike racers are aiming to finish the race with nothing in the tank, to time their effort and expend all their energy in the race. But you can't approach a long-distance ride in that way. You're essentially trying to replenish what you use en route. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and particularly for this PBP, because I'd ridden one 10 days previously, and my brain blanked out from when I'd done a similar thing in 09. I wasn't initially eating enough and the fuel tank went on empty quite severely, sort of twice before the light bulb appeared and went, you have got to eat majorly at every control, because the UAF PBP had basically emptied my reserves. So then eating became a real major thing to happen at every single control, even if it was food you didn't really fancy. It's, you've got to eat. It's really important.
What kind of intake do you need?
I think people say somewhere between about 10,000 calories per 24 hours. Does that sound about right?
I don't know. I don't measure calories. Yeah. But basically, you're having a proper meal every 3 to 4 hours all the time you're awake.
And is that difficult to eat it while you're actually riding?
I think everyone's different. For me, if it's the weather conditions are fairly cool, as they were in PBP, generally eating's not a problem. But when it gets hot, and I know a lot of other people suffer as well, when it gets hot and you get a bit dehydrated, then you know your appetite tends to disappear, and you know you've got to eat, but forcing food down you is, you know, a major problem for me and for a lot of riders, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the agony and the ecstasy. Let's start with the agony. Come on, that's what everyone wants to hear. And then we'll get on to the ecstasy. What are the darkest moments of a very, very long ride like this for you guys?
I think we've only had one, really.
Yeah.
And that was in 09 on Sydney Melbourne Alpine, because of the fact that it was such a hard ride and it was the fourth of an international super randonneur series that I was doing over 6 months. So that not working out was like a really big deal. But on the whole, I've really enjoyed the rides. They've just been a lot of fun. But I come from a long-distance racing background. So for me, riding these long distances is a very relaxed process. Rather than chasing, say, 12-hour records, it's just fun.
Where's the fun? You are feeling tired, right? You are feeling worn out. And do you not ever have to dig really deep into your mental reserves to keep going and think, why can't I just stop and check into this really nice, comfortable-looking B&B and put my head down on a freshly laundered white pillow and just snooze for what is a normal sleep for 8 hours?
I think partially it's that I've mastered the art of night riding now. Night riding isn't a problem. I can just do it, and I can do it successively. No matter how many rides I do now in a season, the night riding on the whole is not a problem. And it's the challenge. I don't want to fail, because I've got a collection of these rides and I want to add the next one to the collection. So it's the not wanting to fail. It's also being able to draw on the racing experiences and the experiences I've had as a randonneur to find strategies to make your way through when things are difficult.
And what are those strategies?
Oh, a whole host of them, from what to eat, what to drink, don't let help annoy you. If there's a mechanical problem, it will resolve itself like it did in 99. It's just slowly learning things and filing them in the memory banks to pull out when you need it again.
Dave, what have you learned? Have you become a better randonneur?
I don't know about better. I'm a bit more persistent, I guess. You talked about the darkest moments. Well, that's pretty accurate for me. You know, sometime between midnight and dawn gets to be really tough. The falling asleep thing, yep, that tends to happen. The losing the drive, losing the focus, losing the enjoyment. So I try to sleep through that bit. So try to plan the ride enough that I can ride fast enough to get enough sleep, that I sleep through the bad patch, 2, 3, 4 hours, whatever it is, and get back on the bike next day, sun comes up, and it's another beautiful day to ride a bike. It sounds great to me.
Pete, what were your sleep strategies?
I didn't really have any set strategy as such. I have suffered before trying to ride through the night, but actually on PBP wasn't too bad this year. I can't say why. Maybe I was quite well rested before, I guess, on the ride. It's quite exciting. There's a lot of people out on the road to ride with. But I did have one sort of dark moment, and I'd ridden to Brest pretty much without sleeping. I got there after about 33 hours. But I'd booked a hotel in Brest because I knew that it's good to have somewhere to aim for and get rested. But when I got to Brest, I couldn't find the hotel. And not only that, but I had a rider with me in tow who I'd kind of met at the previous control and promised him this fantastic hotel and a bed and a shower. And I was riding around the kind of Periphique or something in Brest trying to find this hotel at 5 o'clock in the morning, and eventually couldn't find it, had to abandon and get back on the route and just head back. And I think had that happened to me a couple of years ago when I first started an LEL, I would have just jacked it in and phoned home and said that's it. But the experience taught me, look, you just got to put it behind you and just get on with it. And you know that it was hard at the time, but in retrospect you think you overcame something that mentally might have been quite overwhelming at the time. But you sort of go into a parallel universe where you just accept these things and move on. And you know, that's one of the real beautiful things about doing something like Paris.
And how do you go about riding within yourself and not taking off at a speed that's unsustainable, because there's that terrible temptation, isn't there?
Well, Judith will tell you that I tend to take off and hang with people who are too fast, blow up, and then grovel for a bit, at which point Judith catches me up, and we then ride along for a bit and until the legs come round again. So,
how do you discipline yourself, Judith?
I think it's the amount of time trialling, particularly on the tandem that I did. You kind of, there's a groove and you just hop in it, and it's just metronomic. You just push out this pace, and the idea is to start slow, finish strong. So like on this PBP, I had a wonderful time on the Wednesday because I sort of lost the group I was riding with, and I just spent the whole day catching riders. And then the night into Mortain, I was riding with Edwin Greaves on his tricycle, and I was on my Moulton, and we were just catching riders hand over fist, and it was just so much fun whizzing down the hills, and they couldn't believe it as three wheels came one side, trolley wheels the other, and we're chatting as we're going up the climbs and going past lots of carbon. It was just great fun. So that's how.
I've really restrained myself to get this far into the show as a Moultonier myself without drawing the listeners' attention to the fact that Dave and Judith, you were both this year and in previous long distance rides on these marvellous bicycles from Bradford-on-Avon, just to be different, or are they generally more comfortable?
Having ridden big wheels and ridden a tandem, Casper the Little White Moulton is just the bee's knees. I mean, it's just a fantastic bike. I mean, it just rides perfectly. It rides better than my favourite big wheel bike.
I've done lots of long rides on big wheels and a fair few, three PBPs on various Moultons, one on a Moulton Stowaway and the next two on the Pashleys, and I like the comfort. We didn't take the Moultons over to America when we did the Texas 1200 in May, and given the road surfaces there, I really wished we'd had.
Because of the vibration dampening effects of the suspension, presumably.
That's right, and the joints on the road, they're just really tough road surfaces.
And so, Pete, if you're being passed by a small wheeler, is that a bit like a marathon runner in the London Marathon being passed by the squaddy in the rhino outfit as you're running up the mall? You know, that sort of sinking feeling. Or are you not prejudiced?
Well, I'm not prejudiced. I'm sure you would think, right, I'm going to push on a bit here and have a go, but sort of Judith that came past me, I think, well, she's a pretty experienced rider. I'll just hang back here and, cool my guns for a bit. So,
do you have to be a cool customer to do well in these things? Do you have to not have an ego?
I'm not sure about an ego. You have to be fairly self-reliant. I mean, Paris is a huge event, but in order to get there, you have to do qualifying events. And those qualifying events, long-distance events, 200 up to a 600-kilometre events, and you'll almost invariably end up on your own on those events at some stage. And so you need to be reasonably self-reliant. It's not the big kind of party that Paris can be. So I think, you have to be fairly happy in your own skin, certainly.
Well, for the last couple of minutes of the show, I want to talk about how people who are perhaps tempted by what we've been talking about on the show this week and what Kieran Yates presented in his documentary of the Paris last week, for people who would like to give it a go, what are the first steps that they should be taking, and what are the good medium to long distance rides that people should do in the UK, I'd say?
Well, there's the Audax UK website's the the first place to look. It's got the calendar, and there's rides every weekend of the year, pretty much. The ones now tend to be pretty short, 100k or 200k, which is kind of nice given it gets dark early. Stretching out to the classic rides in May, June, July, things like the Brian Chapman 600 is probably the most prestigious normal length ride, you know, annual ride in the UK.
And that's from one end of Wales to the other and back.
That's right, in a weekend. So you start from just near the Severn Bridge and go up to the Menai Bridge and back down to the Severn Bridge again. For any more information, I suppose something like YACF, the forum, has got...
Yet another cycling forum, yeah.
That's the one. Has got probably more UK Audaxes on than anywhere else.
And what kind of bike do people need to get involved in
anything.
This?
Anything. To start with, anything. It doesn't matter, providing the wheels go around. I mean, somebody completed the Beast from the East 600 on quite a low-tech bike. It's the rider that counts, not the bike.
Yeah, as long as you're comfortable, anything will do.
Yeah, I mean, comfort, I think, is the major thing. You're on it for a long time, so you don't really want deep section rims or something that's super stiff like a racing bike, because, you know, you're on the bike for a long time, it's going to be really uncomfortable. Speed isn't ultimately that important over such a long distance.
Yeah, so what sort of speeds are we talking about, so people can kind of visualise the kind of speeds that you're trucking along at?
Average rolling on rolling terrain might be 15 miles an hour, maybe a shade less on the longer rides.
Yeah, that'd be about... I always think of it in kilometres. That Audax rides are always listed in kilometres, so, and it also makes it seem go quicker. But, around about 25 kilometres an hour would be about the kind of rolling speed that you do. Yeah, maybe up to 30 if it's... conditions are favourable, but rarely more than that.
And so you'd recommend people do a couple of 200 kilometres and then think about 300, 400? Is that the way to do it?
It's the sensible way.
Yeah.
It's not like... We don't all start that way. Some of us just jump in the deep end, but no, that's the logical way. Start with the little rides and work your way up.
All right. Dave.
Yeah, work your way up to the fun ones. The 1200s are the fun ones, and PVP is it.
Well, you could just go for London, Edinburgh, London in 2013 and jump straight in.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Judith Swallow, Dave Minter and Pete Kelsey. And Pete has a great kind of stop frame type of film about his Paris-Brest-Paris, which is available on the web, and I will put a link to that on Bike Show's webpage. Tune in next week, where we'll be talking a little bit about the competitive urge with Jen Kerrison, who's here on crutches. Hey, Jen.
Bye there, see you next week.
Yeah, all right, thanks for listening. One Life Left is up next. Cheerio, bye-bye. Man, I went to do the little bicycle scam. He ain't got nothing just for you to gain. He leaves the one to feel a pain. I'm going to go there on a bicycle. The youth man gone on him tricycle. Some of them are eat up the icicle. But not he going to go there on him bicycle. Say that me make two pedal fi go win gold medal. Make two pedal fi go win gold medal. Make he go deh on the bicycle. That he go and go deh on the bicycle. But watch a man, been down to Westmoreland to buy piece of land. Here came the owner man a drive up in a van. But here we go deh on a Chris 21. Man a go and go deh on a Chris 21. Sometime ride Ghana you a turn you know. Sometime ride Ghana Portland, watch a man. Say me a man of some merit and you know. Me a go ride, go while you a turn, watch a man. Say me a man of some merit.
Good evening, London. Hello, the world. This is Resonance 104.4 FM, the greatest radio station on the planet. And this is a video game radio show. This is One Life Left. good evening and welcome to One Life Left. We're a radio show about video games. I'm Steve Curran.
Hello, I am Simon Byron.
And I'm Anne Scantlebury.
For the next hour, we're going to be talking about video games, because that's what a radio game about. Video games. Radio show about games should do. It should do speaking perfectly. It evidently isn't.
So we follow the bike show, or we are following the bike show as we do normally.
And how do you follow that?
Well, what was he listening to? If anybody who joined us at 7 o'clock on Resonance, it was reggae, wasn't he? I don't want to cast any, but has he been smoking? Has Jack been smoking stuff?
I don't think you can if you're a biker.
Cyclist.
Apparently he had members of the cabinet in here.
Really?
So what have they been getting up to?
No, I don't think that was this week, was it?
Is it not?
A cabinet.
Obviously, we couldn't listen to the bike show live because we were biddy. What's going on?
Steve.
We were busy preparing, obviously not practicing our elocution.
Smoke that's in the studio is making it difficult to concentrate.
We are
Gilbert
and George.
And this is
Resonance 104 4FM.
The art of listening. You can donate money
to keep this lovely station alive via the website.